Okay.
Just ready, let me know, and I'll introduce you.
Okay.
And then you can just stick that
like in my pocket. And it won't turn off.
It's already on.
Okay.
It shouldn't turn off.
Okay. I'm ready whenever you are. Yeah.
I am very pleased today to introduce Heather Rose, who's a faculty member in the School of Education here at UC Davis. Heather got her PhD in economics from UC San Diego. Did I say that right?
Yes.
About 10 years ago, and she worked at the Public Policy Institute of California for about 7 years before coming here. And she has worked on a wide number of topics related to education policy and published in both economics and education journals. So she comes to us with a lot of expertise, and she's going to talk to us today about school finance in California and how that affects poor children. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I'm particularly happy to be here today. How many of you were at the event last night that was co-hosted by the Poverty Center and the School of Education? So there's a lot of talk about school finance issues there, so I feel like now I have the opportunity to set the record straight on a few things. So I needed my platform today so I don't walk around my house ranting like a crazy person. So this is good. So I want to talk about school finance issues through the lens of this question, which is, how does our finance system help or not help poor children? Is it leaving our poor students behind? And so if you want the quick answer, so you can just go on with your Friday afternoon, here's one answer for you. No. For those of you who don't like that answer, I've got the other answer, which is yes. So all of this is just to say that by the end of the hour and 20 minutes, I'm not really going to give you a specific answer to this question. I think it's pretty murky. But I want to sort of sort through some of the details that I think are important to think about when thinking about this issue in the first place. So before I get started with the nitty-gritty, I want to just sort of lay out what the big education reforms have been over the last few decades in California. In the 70s and 80s, the state was really focused on equalizing spending per pupil across school districts. So that was there was a big push for that, and I'll sort of show you how far we've come. In the 90s, the state was really focused on sort of providing a floor for spending on education, providing, you know, more resources for schools. And you sort of saw that happening with Proposition 98. Then in 2000, we really started focusing on setting academic standards for the students in the state and having a standards-based accountability system, which has really led to the questions at hand today, which are, have we been providing schools with enough resources to meet those very specified standards now? So it's sort of this question of enough. And then can we design a more rational system for allocating the money we have? So I'm going to sort of focus on the second part of that question, which is the rationality of our finance system today. And so I'm going to take a page out of Hillary's book here. I think when you gave your talk, you had this picture that had been driving your research questions over the last few years. So this is my picture that has really been sort of guiding my research over the last decade, I would say. So every dot on this graph is an elementary school. It's in 2007. And it's plotted based on the percentage of students in this school who scored proficient or higher on the English language arts part of the California standards test. So that's on the vertical axis. And then across the horizontal axis, we have the percentage of economically disadvantaged students in the school. So today, when I talk about economically disadvantaged, the specific thing I mean is the percentage of students in the school who are on the free or reduced price lunch program. And what that means in more practical terms is that they are they come from families that are below 180% of the poverty line. So just to give you an example, in 2007 for a family of four, the poverty line was about $20,000. So we're talking about kids who are less than about $38,000, coming from families that are earning less than about $38,000 in California. So just sort of put that in perspective. So what this shows is that in district or in schools where there are many more poor kids, many fewer of them are scoring proficient on these tests. So this is sort of all feeding into this achievement gap that we have where poor students are not performing as well as the more affluent students in the state. And so this is sort of the guiding picture I have in mind. So in this sense, to the extent that our finance system is related to this, you know, we are leaving quite a few kids behind. If you want to look at a different measure of test scores, this sort of shows the same thing with the API score in the state. This is a score that's assigned to every school based on a whole host of tests. The school, it ranges from 200 to 1,000. The goal for every school is an 800. And I think, if I kind of got crafty here, one of the things I wanted to show you is that if you look, again, this is the same measure of poverty, you know, the worst scoring schools up here are still far better than the best scoring schools where there are high numbers of kids in poverty. So this is sort of one of the fundamental driving issues, I think. So when we think about a school finance system, I definitely want to keep this in mind, and I also want to keep a few principles in mind that would sort of, I don't know, be principles for a more coherent school finance system. And those are, and I should actually say too, please feel free to interrupt with questions throughout. This is, it'll be more fun for me for sure, and for you too probably. So those are the ground rules. But when we think though about principles of a school finance system in theory, one would be that we're actually meeting the needs of the students. So we're sort of giving them enough. The other is that we want to adjust for differences in cost. So perhaps disadvantaged kids have extra needs and we should be supplying them with more resources to address those. Or labor costs might be higher in some districts than others, and we might want to address those with our school finance system as well. But we want to make these cost adjustments based on factors that a district can't control. So if you go back to this picture, we don't necessarily want to give schools more money because their test scores are low, because then they might not have an incentive to raise their test scores if they're going to lose the money. So we might want to give them more money because they have a lot of kids in poverty, and, you know, not base those resource decisions on things that are controllable by the schools themselves. Okay, the other thing we want to do is allocate funds transparently. So we want to adjust for some big costs, but not every single solitary difference between schools, because we'll sort of be back to the crazy system that we're currently in, which we'll talk more about in a second. Once we sort of figure out what cost factors we want to adjust for, any district with the same set of characteristics should be getting the same amount of revenue afterwards. And then finally, and I'm not going to talk too much about this today, but there should be this balance between state and local authority, and that's something else the state has been struggling with. Yeah.
That's a question on the measure of disadvantage.
Yeah.
How accurate is it?
Accurate-ish. So now that my daughter finally entered school, it comes from one pink piece of paper where I check a box. So, partially. So that's partially how accurate it is. Some districts are better than other at getting that information about free and reduced price lunch. But if you actually look at different measures, if you look at the Title I measure, which is a different count of poor kids in the school, which is less subject to the sort of human reporting errors, I think, you get a pretty high correlation with free and reduced price lunch. So I think we're in the ballpark at least. But there are other sort of crazy things that happen with some school districts. If they exceed a certain threshold of that for 1 year, they just continue to report 100% every year thereafter. And actually, this is an important point to bring up, that Maggie Weston is also here, and Maggie has worked with me on all of this. She and John Sonstilly and I have been doing this whole, this sort of comes from a series of projects. So she is going to answer all the tough questions in the room and will correct me when I say anything that's off base. So is that, that's about right. Okay.
Is there any for free and reduced price lunch? Is there ever any income verification audit or anything?
I don't know, actually, to be perfectly honest.
You have to audit 10% of, randomly audit 10% of student applications.
Let's see. Okay. Good.
I think the view is it's pretty sketchy. But, yeah, probably crudely right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, sketchy in terms of the actual...
And,
verification that goes on. But.
Yeah, and, it covers a pretty big group of people. I got school attendance zone data at one point for a prior project, and if you look at that, you can actually get, census income for the families in those school attendance zones. Mm-hmm. And, okay, for my sample of 50 schools, so we're talking a limited sample, I think if you go back to a picture like this, it kind of tightens that up a bit. I mean, these are pretty broad categories of poverty there.
Yeah.
It's an okay-ish measure. It's kind of what we've got, and it's a starting point, but I think we probably can do better. Okay, so specifically what I want to focus on today is talking a lot about the current finance system that we have, kind of where the money comes from, how it's distributed, and how that's related to poverty. So kind of a school finance 101 talk. And then I want to relate this to the governor's new proposal for funding schools, which is this idea of a weighted student formula, which is really the hot topic in school finance today in Sacramento and across the state. So that'll be fun to talk about. And then finally, we'll maybe get to this question of are resources adequate, and we'll get there. Okay. Before, though, I do want to turn the tables for a second and take the attention off me and put it on you and have you do this quick little quiz, which is, you can talk to your neighbors, but answer the following questions. What share of the federal budget is spent on education? What share of the state budget is spent on education? And then finally, think about it now from the school's perspective. What share of their budgets come from federal, state, and then local discretionary sources? And by that I mean the sources that the school district could actually tap into if it wanted, you know, if it wanted to raise more money.
K through 12.
This is K through 12. Thank you. Take a minute. Talk amongst yourselves. No, yeah, and don't, you can't talk to her. What was that?
State budget, the general fund, or the overall?
All right, state budget clarification would be the general fund. General fund. It's the general fund.
That's agreed nationwide or California?
Oh, for California.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
For California.
Hey, I know the answer nationwide.
Do you? Yeah, a question. Or an answer.
But it's mostly 10%.
What was that?
All right, we're good.
85.
Oh, I just mean, those are the only three things. So either the state or the federal or the local. But you'll see in a minute there's some murkiness between that was all I, yeah. All right. I know, I should have gone to that clicker presentation. All right. I'm in a school of ed now. I should know how to manage a room better. But let's get back to attention here. Okay, so Scott said he knew the answer for the first part there, the federal budget.
No, I didn't.
Oh, I thought you did.
The third question for the federal.
Sorry.
National averages, but I didn't know California.
All right, so who wants to venture an answer for the federal?
Less than one.
How many?
Based on how you treat loan guarantees.
Okay.
No, don't. K through 12.
K through 12.
Yeah.
Less than 1%.
Okay. So we have like some really low percentages here. What about the state budget? And by state budget, specifically the general fund. Higher than 30s.
K through 12.
Got some 30s. Okay, we'll go with that. Let's see how we're doing so far. Oh, maybe.
What's the answer on the state?
So we'll start here with the federal. So I'm not even going to give you the right answer there. So education in total is about 3%. Yeah, it's okay. So small, super small is my only point in that. And I know it's bad to present this kind of stuff with people who really do public finance. So really small is the answer. State spending, though, in the general fund, K to 14. So some of this is going to community colleges. It's a pretty small slice, but I guess it isn't there, is it? That is K to 12. Yeah, so it's about 40% of the general fund. And this was sort of a rule set by Proposition 98. So this was part of that 1980s reform where we wanted 40% of our budget to be general fund to go to education, K to 12 education. Okay, now if you think about it from the school's perspective, what share of its money is sort of dictated by the federal government, the state government, and then locally. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Question.
Sure.
When you say general fund, is that the entire money that the state gets?
No.
Well, I thought the question wasn't the entire money that the state gets.
Yeah, so, okay. So you guys are calling me on a lot of technicalities here. So not entirely. And so this is just the general fund. But it is a huge, you know, it's a big part of the general fund. So my point in all of this is really just to say it's not a huge federal spending priority. It is a pretty big state spending priority. But then when you think about it from the perspective of the districts themselves, what portion are they getting? I mean, because, you know, a small piece of a huge pie can still be a lot of money for a school district. So from the school district's perspective, where is it getting its money? So what percentage from the state would you guys say then? We'll just start with that one. 80-ish percent. You guys are good. Yeah, so I'll cut to the chase here. This is basically, I'm sort of want to talk about each four slices of this pie in a lot more detail. But state money, sort of state-controlled money, it basically makes up this huge revenue limit piece, that sort of general money that the school can spend on regular everyday expenses, sort of how it sees fit. These state categorical programs are sort of have a lot of strings tied to them, but this, all of this, about 85%, is coming from state-controlled sources. The federal government supplies about 9%, and then other local discretionary sources are about 6%. So I'll go into each of these slices and sort of talk about how, you know, where the money comes from and then how it's spent based on the poverty level of schools. So far, so good? All right. So I want to talk about this biggest chunk of money first, these revenue limits. And revenue limit is kind of a funny terminology. The way these funds work is the state has basically set a revenue goal for each school district, call it $5,200. And this is sort of an entitlement that every school district should get. The first way money flows into that is through, a big chunk is through property taxes based on the value of the property in the school district zones. Because of Prop 13, these property taxes are capped at 1% of the value of homes in the state. So that 1% is going to vary from school district to school district because the property values themselves vary across the different school districts. And the other reason that that amount might vary is because the portion of that 1% that goes to school districts varies from school district to school district. The portion is set based on whatever proportion school districts were getting of their property taxes back in the late 70s when Proposition 13 was passed. So there's a lot of reasons why this chunk of money is going to vary from school district to school district. But that's the first part that gets a school district up to that revenue limit, that revenue goal. After that, the state is just going to fill in the rest. So it doesn't matter necessarily from a school district's perspective if they get a lot of money from property taxes or they don't, because the state is just going to fill in that difference. And so what this actually looks like for a couple of specific districts here, take Oakland. This is how much Oakland gets toward that goal in terms of its share of local property taxes. So the state is actually putting in a lot of state aid for Oakland's revenue limit. San Francisco, they actually make it up to that $5,200 mark pretty close with just their property taxes alone. So the state is actually giving them just a pretty small amount of additional aid. But then there's a place like Newport Mesa, who's when you take their share of property taxes, it actually exceeds this amount and goes all the way up over $8,000. So they basically get their revenue limit amount of $5,200, and they get to keep all that extra. So that's called an excess tax district. They have taxes in excess of that state goal, and they get to keep it. Now, don't get too worried about this. last night, it became a big topic of conversation. It felt like there were claims that if we just did away with this one issue of our school finance system, we could fix everything. But we really can't. If you basically took all the excess taxes across the state, divided them up among all the kids, you basically have a little sliver like about that. It's about $70 a kid statewide. So this is sort of the statewide average picture where, you know, about a third of the money is coming from property taxes, about two-thirds from state aid, and that tiny little sliver is excess taxes. But because these excess tax districts, they're also sometimes called basic aid districts, just in case you've heard that terminology thrown around. The reason that they are called basic aid districts was because although you know, they're meeting their revenue limit with their taxes alone, they were still entitled to a tiny little bit of state aid. They got the only the basic part of the state aid, which was like a couple, maybe it was like $120 of other state aid, but nothing else, no other state aid above and beyond that. So just to point out a few of these places, because I think people are kind of interested in them sometimes, here's a list of the top 24 unified districts with excess taxes. So Owens Valley Unified basically has excess taxes in the amount of $2,500 per people, but there's only 37 kids there. So not very, I mean, we could probably not worry about them. And so you can kind of see St. Helena's kind of in there in Napa County. They have $9,000 of excess taxes. These are the top 24. Actually, once you get down below this one, the amount of, there's like nine others that have nine others that have excess taxes, you know, somewhere between $100 and $900. And one thing that actually happens, some of the reasons why a district might be called an excess tax district now, is because remember we have that $5,200 revenue limit amount, the goal, and if a district had gotten all of that revenue limit with excess taxes, it wouldn't be getting any state aid. But what happened with some of the budget cuts recently is that the state decreased those revenue limits, and so by just simply dropping the amount that the state was targeting for every school district, some school districts were sort of thrown into this category without necessarily having become better off in any other sense. So just
to ground California relative to the rest of the U.S., if you go back a slide, what's the national average for the share of costs that property versus state? I mean, I know it's much higher, but just how much of an outlier are we?
Yeah, so actually this is something that Maggie and I are working on, thanks to actually one of the Poverty Center GSR grants, where we're really trying to look at this nationwide. And it's kind of tricky because in California we have this issue where although we have this 1% property tax that is considered a local tax with the federal data, it essentially is this statewide tax. It's not a local discretionary tax in the sense that a school district could raise their mm-hmm. property tax rate and get more revenue in that sense. So trying to get a better handle on which, you know, how to classify money and sort of under the state purview or under local purview. So I don't know, can you?
I said 44% local, 44% state. The rest, 8, whatever,
is 12. Yeah, so kind of more like half and half.
Only 12 states have a majority coming from states.
Thank you. Yeah.
So how does, Serrano 3, that limited their range in poor people spending across districts, how does this tax fit into that?
So the Serrano versus Priest lawsuit was basically what led to this equalization push in California in the first place. And the way that kind of worked was the state said, we want to have this revenue limit of, I'll just say, $5,200 per kid. And at that point, there were some districts that were really close to that and some districts that were really far away from it. What that meant was that if you were far away from that limit, you were allowed to set a tax rate that you could grow to that limit a lot faster than if you were really close to it. So it's kind of a limit in the sense that districts, not many districts were there yet, and it wanted districts to get there within a certain amount of time and to close that, you make sure that all districts were spending within $100 per pupil of each other. But there were some technicalities there, and now Maggie can correct me. She'll see if I was really listening to her when she was giving me the details on this. But the rule was that I think 90% of school districts had to be within that, or 90% of students had to be within that $100 band. And if you adjust that $100 band for inflation, which it was, we're kind of right now at a $400 band. And so, actually, if you look at revenue limits, we've broken this up by, these are elementary districts, these are high school districts, and these are unified districts. So let's just take this slice right here first. There are large, medium, and small, and these are just box and whisker plots, so sort of showing you where half of, or this is the 75th percentile, this is the 25th percentile of students, actually, in these districts. But basically, large unified districts, there's almost no variation in revenue limit funds for them. So that's where most of the students are. Medium unified, you get a little bit of spread. Small unified, you're still kind of, you know, most of the kids are within that few hundred dollars of each other. And then you have some outliers. So by and large, this source of funding has been pretty equalized across districts. The one big difference, though, is that those revenue limits are different for unified districts than they are for high school districts and elementary districts. So high school districts have a higher revenue limit. It's just over 6,000. Unified districts have a revenue limit or goal of about 5,200, and elementary districts are closer to 5,000. So you'll get differences in school spending based on the type of school district that you are. And those are sort of born into the distribution formula, because the Serrano decision, you know, sort of set these revenue limits in that way. Does that answer your question? Okay, so this is just sort of overall how these funds are distributed, but what I really wanted to focus on is, well, how is this related to poverty? But I guess I didn't want to do that yet, because I want to focus when I go through this on unified districts, just to sort of keep the graphs a little bit simpler. So just to put this in perspective, the state has unified districts, which serve K to 12, elementary districts, which are usually K up until you get to high school, and then high school districts after that. About 67% of students are in unified districts. That's where most kids are. About 20% in elementary, and about 10% in high school districts. So I'm going to focus the pictures on this, but the other ones look pretty similar. So if we look at this question of revenue limit funds, so these are revenue limit funds up here on a per pupil basis. This again is that measure of poverty, the percent of kids on free or reduced price lunch. Here every circle is a school district, and the size of the circle is based on the enrollment in that school district. So this big school district right here is Los Angeles. It's got about 10% of the students in the whole state, so it's pretty big. And this is really just to show you that revenue limit funds have been pretty equalized. It's a pretty straight line across here by district type. So these are just the unified districts. There's not much variation. If anything, these districts at the high end of the poverty distribution get a tiny bit more. If you run a regression, you get an intercept of about 5,300 with a slope of about 25. But this is if you don't include the excess taxes. If you actually include the excess taxes in that definition of revenue limits, what happens is you get a few more affluent districts with some of those excess taxes. So you actually get a negative, if you were to, I mean, it doesn't really show up here visually that well, but if you run a regression, you actually get sort of a negative relationship now between funding and poverty. You get an intercept of about 5,600 with a negative slope of about 354, meaning that basically every poor kid is getting about $354 less on average than a kid who would not be classified as poor with this definition. So revenue limits, the big chunk of money, pretty equalized, but those excess taxes mean that more affluent kids are getting a little bit more. But
to be poor.
Oh, thank you.
This is a pretty big effect.
We'll come back. Yeah. So that's sort of the general funding for schools, sort of the ongoing regular education expenses. But then we have that other set of categorical programs that make up it's about like $2,000 worth of the overall funding. And there are at least 60 different categorical programs in the state. This is the biggest one here is special education. Economic impact aid is about 8% of the slice. That is basically doled out based on whether a kid is poor or not. That definition Maggie, I'm going to let you give that definition because you'll remember it better than I. So it's if you're English learners and Title I, either of those, and you can get double counted, but it's about $300 per eligible kid. Class size reduction is another categorical program. This was to give schools additional money to reduce their class sizes in grades kindergarten through third. There's like adult education programs. So lots of little tiny programs. So about 75% of the funds in this program, though, come from the 10 biggest programs. So there's a lot of big programs giving a lot of money, but lots of little tiny programs with lots of little strings attached that, when you talk to school districts, kind of drive them crazy. So if we look, though, at how this money is, if you take all of this, and actually, I'm not going to quite take all of it, I'm going to take special education out. It's kind of hard sometimes to think about special education and what part of the money comes from the state and what part of the money comes from the feds. So for the rest of this talk, we're just going to ignore the special education funds for a minute. But just know that there was some reform in how we allocated special education revenue not that long ago, and it's pretty much doled out on an equal per pupil basis across these things called SELPAs, which are these special education local plan areas. So sort of groups of districts that are part of these SELPAs. The SELPAs get a money sort of on a per kid rate, and then that group sort of decides how it's going to spend those funds. So these categorical funds, if you look at how they're related to poverty, there's a pretty steep positive slope here where more disadvantaged kids are getting more money. And on average, that means about an extra $1,800 per poor child. So a really strong relationship with poverty here. So revenue limit funds, revenue limit funds, you don't really get this picture, but these are a pretty strong positive relationship. The next slice of the pie I want to talk about are federal programs. And here, Title I is the biggest of the federal programs, and is also a program designed to help poor children. So we should probably expect to see a pretty steep upward slope there as well. You don't see much of a slope here, but it definitely is. You're getting more federal funds as your poverty level increases, and certainly out here you can see that districts with more disadvantaged students end up with a lot more federal revenue. Questions? Good. Okay.
Are you doing weighted or unweighted?
These are weighted, actually. Yes. Yeah. So the slopes that I'm showing you are weighted.
A lot of it's high because of Los Angeles.
Right. In this one, yeah. But like if you go back to the...
It's fine.
Yeah. No, LA definitely pulls things up. And
I think you're doing it right.
Yeah. And then that's certainly also important keep that in mind when we come back to talk about what the state's been talking about in terms of school finance reform later, because certainly what's happening in LA is kind of a driving force about what's possible to do statewide. Okay, and then the last little sliver I want to talk about here are the local revenue sources. And so these are, if a district's leasing or renting out its land, stuff that it has access to, that makes up about 20%. It can also raise parcel taxes. So these are not based on the value of your land, but based on whether you have a unit of land or not. So that makes up about 10% of those local fees. So we're talking overall, this part of the pie is about $600 per pupil, so that's about $60 per pupil statewide. So pretty small in terms of revenue-raising capabilities on a statewide basis.
And what's the 46? Excess property tax things end up? Are they in here?
They're in the revenue limit chunk. They're in that big,
in the first thing
that we saw, yeah. Yeah.
Gosh, that's so interesting. I think probably most people's priors is that the parcel taxes would be the majority of this.
Yeah, it's a pretty tiny piece. So if you actually look, so here's I just pulled out a few to give you a taste of who's getting these. So LA has no parcel taxes. Berkeley has they end up raising about $3,000 per student in parcel taxes.
Right, exactly.
Davis is about $800. And so you can, this is just to give you sort of a sense here. There aren't that many districts that actually have parcel taxes. I think I counted this morning. There are 100 districts, I guess, with parcel taxes that end up providing more than $100 per student. So I guess that's about 10% of districts have something, but not necessarily a lot. And it could be that some of those districts, for whatever reason, are sort of lower on the revenue limit side of things in the first place. So you wouldn't want to read too much into just this one piece of the pie. And if you look then at what's happening with local revenue, taking all those sources together, and we look at the same picture, you kind of get this negative slope where more affluent districts, through those various forms, are able to raise more money locally than districts with higher levels of poverty. So we have these sort of countervailing sources of, you know, federal and state categorical programs really are targeted toward poor students and are going to districts in the way that you would expect, but these are sort of other local and funds aren't. Yeah.
Taken into account the foundations that are established by some local districts.
Yeah. So these foundations. So foundation funds. If they don't end up in the district's books, I don't have them in here. And so voluntary contributions, sort of donations from, you know, the public and the parents, usually aren't in here. I mean, I suppose in some cases they could end up in a district's local coffers if they're given to the district, but if they're just spent directly from the foundation that raised them, we won't necessarily have access to that here. Although Maggie's been working, I mean, there has been some work in this area in the past that have looked at voluntary contributions and which districts have been able to raise them. It's a pretty small, you might remember this more off the top of your head than I will.
It's really hard to track because you have to go through the IRS 990 forms of the PTA, mm-hmm. the booster clubs, whatever, and you don't really know what proportion of their total revenue. You just know what they raise and what they spend.
The propaganda in Davis that we're going to be able to have this teacher and we're going to have these people, all of it sounded mm-hmm. like school employees, frankly.
Yeah.
So maybe they're misleading us.
Well, they can certainly, I mean, no, I mean, they certainly are, and I mean, and you've got a lot of that data, and we're trying to match it up to which, you know, school district that they would be part of, and to get a sense of how much revenue they're raising. Some districts are very successful at using these, and there are some prior studies that have looked at how much involuntary contributions are raised and can show you that by district.
Well, there's that movie that I saw a long time ago that compares these. Poor school district in one of the East Bay schools districts, and then one in the Walnut Creek into that area. I forget which one it is.
Yeah.
And one had, you know, broken windows and all that, and the other one had great uniforms for their bands and music and art and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where does all that money come from?
Well, so some of it will come from these. You know, there are those handful of districts. I mean, I think this is one of my pet peeves with a lot of the education stuff that gets put out there, which is you can always pick a school that looks really crummy and a school that looks really great and compare and contrast them. But if you sort of go out and pick, and we did this with 50 schools. We sort of randomly selected schools in this stratified way. So we wanted some wealthy, you know, from higher income areas and some from poorer areas to really get a sense of what it looks like. And we didn't see those, we didn't see those huge gaping gaps between the more, schools, facilities necessarily in the more affluent areas and the poor areas. I don't know. I think you could always pick a couple districts and make whatever comparison you want. So, and it's a way to really get people worked up about an issue, too. So it's a good marketing ploy, for sure. So if we sort of just sum up these pictures of revenue for unified districts, you know, these were the slopes for the categorical and federal components. There was a lot of extra money going to poor students, but you sort of get these negative slopes for revenue limits and these local sources. On average, it worked out to about $2,000 extra that every poor student was generating for their school district, which I want to call that right now. Yeah.
I just got to say, that's not the right interpretation of the slope, because the slope is going from 0 to 100, or 0 to 1. It goes from no free and reduced price to
100%.
That means moving your school from a no poor kid to all poor kids.
Right.
Which is very different. I'm not saying that number isn't right.
Right. No, okay, that's fine. Right.
It's not a regression of the cost on number of poor kids. That would be the right interpretation if the right-hand side were...
Okay, so it's on the percentage. You're right.
Right, it's the share.
It's the share.
So it's a variable that varies between 0 and 1, so the 2,140...
So this is how...
movement from 0 to 1, unless your right-hand side variable is 0 to 100.
No, it's 0 to 1. So basically going from no kids on free and reduced price lunch to all kids on free and reduced price lunch, you're getting that much extra. Right. Right. So, but if you look at this then on a per kid basis, if you then took that and said you only had 10% extra per kids you'd base on free and reduced price lunch, I know what you're saying, and I should be a little bit more careful when I do that, but you know, in the sense that you are going from nobody to everybody, this is how much extra each of them is getting. No. And this is, I mean, I think we're right now trying to think about the best way to explain this in a way that sort of the Sacramento audience will understand, too, to sort of show which components of these are related to poverty, which aren't, how you sort of decompose this overall difference. So we haven't really got the language on that figured out to my liking exactly yet.
I'd say the average and then, you know, look at examples and tales.
Yeah.
Prototypical types of schools look that way, you know, quartiles of, or something.
Mm-hmm.
Typically.
Yeah. But let me show you the picture of that then, if you take all those revenue sources together, and you do sort of see this sort of upward sloping line when you take all of that revenue into account. So this is the sense, I would say, in which our current system isn't necessarily leaving poor students behind if you look at total revenue. On average, they are in districts that have higher levels of revenue than districts with all affluent students. And I think that's one thing that sort of escapes a lot of the discussion, and that I think a lot of the advocacy groups that are focused on generating more revenue for schools with poverty will sort of show pictures like this without weighting things, or sort of take the sort of case of taking examples from over here and comparing them to examples down here. And that's a lot of what happens in the education debate these days. So I really want to sort of, you know, we wanted to sort of methodically show what each of these pieces is like. And I've actually cut off this. I mean, there are some guys floating around way up all over there too. Just a few. So this is kind of the overall picture with unified districts. I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay, so I don't know if I really want to talk about this right now. This might open up a whole can of worms that I don't know if I really want to get into. This is the column that I just sort of summarized with unified districts, where if you have all students in poverty, you're basically getting about 31% more than with no students in poverty. This sort of 30%, I want you to keep in mind when we talk about the governor's proposal for funding schools, because this is sort of an idea of maybe how much extra a poor student should be getting. If you take, so I, remember, this is just for unified districts. I was sort of leaving out elementary and high school districts. If you put all districts together and do this sort of same thing, overall, you don't get as much additional revenue. And that's because the relationship is, you know, the broad pictures look pretty much the same for the elementary and high school districts, but the differences aren't always significant. There aren't that many high school districts. And I think it's kind of hard to make these comparisons because there's a reason those high school districts have stayed high school districts over time. And if you go back to that first graph where I showed you the difference in revenue limits for high school districts and elementary districts, if you were to sort of lump a high school and its appropriate elementary districts together and make them a unified district, they would actually, how do I want to say this? well, what do I want to, how do I want to say this? I guess I want to say it sort of the other way around. If you take a unified district, they're getting less than they probably should be if you were to take what high school districts get and what elementary student districts get and weight those amounts appropriately and then figure out what that would be. So right now, high school districts that are out there for a reason, because if they somehow unified, they probably would be getting a lot less.
Are there any economies of scale in administration?
Funny you should ask. No. Actually, one of the EDD. No, one of the EDD students in our Kendall program. Actually, his dissertation is looking at district level data across a lot of these different dimensions, and in particular, administration and what happens across small, medium, and big school districts. And then, kind of more interesting, Lee, if you can actually look at districts that have merged over time, seeing what happens to their administrative districts. And I think there are economies of scale, I mean, in administration. You can kind of see that bearing out.
Yeah.
But
going admin without having to unify.
Yeah.
The high school district gets to keep it $6,000 for people. They can share, have the same administrator. And a lot, including Santa Rosa, Santa Cruz, Petaluma, do that.
Yeah. So a lot of the reason why you would see separate districts now are there's a financial benefit to staying that way. So I don't know. I like sort of looking at the unified as the what you might expect, sort of vaguely what you might expect if you really did consolidate everything else. Okay, so I think that kind of does it for the lay of the land where we are right now. But given the policy discussions that have been going on about changing our school funding formula, I want to talk about what Governor Brown has actually proposed specifically. Yeah.
Can I ask a question before you do that?
Sure.
Is, like you said, you're looking at 50 schools and so on. Is there, say, with those 50 schools, a way of figuring out what total additional resources the schools are getting from PTAs, you know, all those things that we as parents write checks to, you know, the Davis, whatever it is, parts, and so on. I mean, is there some way of, I mean, even with PTA stuff, that could provide an upper bound on what resources?
Well, and the data that Maggie was talking about, you actually can do this pretty big scale in some sense, and some researchers have done that in the past, and she's starting to do that now with sort of, I think, even a better understanding of that data and how it works. So you can get at that, and I can't remember off the top of my head right now.
Is it fair to say it's relatively small?
Oh yeah.
The other stuff that
oh yeah, it's tiny. It's kind of like
students, that's between 2 and 7% of this total.
I think of it a lot like sort of the magnitude of parcel taxes. It's kind of a different way of raising that local revenue.
And that might have changed with the recession, right? And so that's why.
Yeah. Okay, so this, I mean, I've been working in this area for 10 plus years, and I feel like, I mean, so some of you have seen me give a slightly different version of the same talk before, so things haven't changed in a lot of ways. But in about 2007, there was this huge research undertaking called Getting Down to Facts that really focused the spotlight on school finance reform. I mean, at PPIC, we'd been doing that for a few years even before, so this really has been, you know, on my radar screen for quite a while. But it's gotten really exciting lately because Governor Brown actually did propose something new. And he did this as part of his January budget. So this wasn't sort of like a necessarily done through. I mean, this it was kind of interesting for me to see the political process play out here. But it wasn't done through what some people might have liked to see done through a policy committee where they're sort of rethinking how we fund our schools in general. He really tried to make this happen with his budget proposal. So I think that was one sense in which there was some opposition to it. Maggie and I testified at one of the budget committee hearings, and there was a lot of talk among the members there, like, why are we doing this in this budget process and not through the policy process? So that was kind of interesting to see. But what his proposal, that original one, wanted to do was to consolidate funding from about 40 different sources, revenue limits, that big chunk being one of them, and then a lot of other categorical programs, provide that in the following way. Basically, let every student generate a certain base amount, call it $5,000, well, it was $49.20, but basically every student would get $5,000. And then on top of that, there would be additional funds for disadvantaged students. And they would get 37% more than that base. So if that base was about $5,000, every disadvantaged student would be generating for their district an extra $1,850. But the amount that every disadvantaged student generated actually grew in a nonlinear way, so that once a district hit, I mean, it grew nonlinearly after a district hit 50% of its kids being disadvantaged. And rather than spell out what that formula is, I'll just show you a picture in just a second. Well, actually, I'll just show you a picture right now. So basically, once you hit this 50% mark, the amount of additional revenue that every student would generate kind of would increase at a much faster rate. So that if you were looking at a district with all of its students in poverty, they would be getting close to almost $9,000 per pupil relative to a district with no students in poverty. They'd be more at the $5,000 mark. So this was phase one of the proposal. And let me
just so I understand, this is the state aid part?
This is sort of the whole, most of the whole shebang. So take out the local stuff, take out some of the categorical programs which are there because of court cases, things that the legislature doesn't really have control over. But a lot of the other categorical programs were going to be in there. So this was taking about, you know, a lot of the funding that we currently have and doling it out in this very specific way.
So the federal money is in this or not in this?
This federal money is not in this. So it's the like property taxes, general state aid, and a lot of categorical programs.
Just a quick question. I mean, on the political process. I mean, the bottom line though was supposed to reduce. He was doing it through the budget process because the ultimate. there was going to be ultimately a reduction, like he was going to cut a bunch of the categoricals, or not? I mean, right, otherwise why would there be, if it was to simplify, it had to have been more than just to simplify.
It was to simplify. So
they must have been to overall reduce, right?
No. Mm-mm.
I believe, you know, reading Dan Walters in the Sacramento Bee, he just rails on and on and on about how ridiculously complicated all these categoricals are and how, you know, some of them, there are vested interests. There's one or two school districts that really benefit from it, et cetera. And I think there's been a big push right for a long time.
But I guess I was just thinking, why would he go through the budget process if it was just about simplification? There had to have been more than just to
fight the vested interests.
Because it was an easier way to get the job done than to put it in these policy committees, I think. So there was sort of a political reason.
Presumably cost saving at district level, so you don't have to do all the reporting.
I mean, I think that certainly is one argument in favor of simplification. Mike Kirst is really behind these weighted student formulas too. He actually wrote a piece as part of the Getting Down to Facts research that sort of laid out a potential weighted student formula. So this is like one of, I mean, I think you could think of it this as one of his, like, he wants to make this change. He wants to make this improvement in education. And this is what a lot of the research has been pointing to over the last decade, and this was a way that he thought he could actually do it. So, I mean, there are some budgetary reasons. And this is kind of a mechanism he could actually use. But, I mean, and here's one of the issues, and one of the reasons why it wasn't necessarily successful that first time around, is that they had to do it the first year, if they were going to implement it, with the money that was available. Mm-hmm. And the money that school districts were entitled to through Proposition 98. So if right now you did something like this, well, let's see. Actually, maybe I'll just show you this picture so we can talk about it a little bit more specifically. So right now, the way this policy worked was we're going to start off with a base of $5,000. It was going to be phased in over 6 years. 5% of the money was going to be allocated according to this new formula in the first year. The other 90%, 5% wasn't. Next year it would be like 20, 80, 30, I forget the actual phase in. And the idea was that revenue for the state was going to grow over the next few years, so there would be more money in the system, and so there wouldn't necessarily be losers and winners in the long run. One of the interesting things, and one of the reasons that Maggie and John and I got involved in this, was because the government couldn't really tell us right then how much every district was getting in each of these programs right now and how much it would be getting with this new formula. And so one of the projects that we did was put together that data. And we actually, I mean, so Maggie knows where to get all of those pieces and has created this great database, which is available to anybody who wants it. And we built this simulation model in Excel where you can actually list the categorical programs you want to consolidate, enter a new funding formula, hit a little run button, which was exciting. My little contribution for the macros behind all this. No. And basically get a lot of before and after pictures for districts. So you can actually see what every district got before and after. And then we wrote some reports about this to sort of help direct or shape the policy discussions. And so this is a picture from one of those reports where for unified districts, this sort of plots unified districts' current level of spending, again, with the percentage of disadvantaged students. The squares are the big districts with more than 10,000. The dots are the smaller districts. And what you can see is that in the long run, when that base got high enough up to that $7,000 mark, this is what every district would be getting with the new formula. This is what it's currently getting. And what you can see is that a lot of districts down here with a lot of disadvantaged students would be gaining a lot more than the districts over here. But one of the issues was that first year, if this were implemented like tomorrow, this line wouldn't be up here. This line would be starting off right here. And these guys up here would be the losers, and these guys down here would be the winners. And that wasn't going over very well. So needless to say, this didn't actually pass as part of the budget in January. And they kind of went back to the drawing table and revised it a little bit. Let me just talk a little bit about those revisions. I have pictures for elementary and high school districts as well. But let me just sort of summarize the overall changes that you would have gotten with that first proposal. And it was that for any, for any district type, let's say unified districts, districts with high poverty, this is sort of the percentage of disadvantaged students. So districts with 80 to 100% of disadvantaged students would be gaining about $4,000 per pupil relative to those with the fewest disadvantaged students. They would have only been gaining $1,200 per pupil. So you have little winners and big winners there. But the other thing that sort of happened with this first pass was take any slice of disadvantage level that you want. Let's just take this middle one. Unified and elementary districts were gaining about twice as much as high school districts. And that's because high school districts were already had these higher revenue limits to start off with. So this was sort of one of the technical issues that caused them to go back to the drawing board. And so the second round of this happened in May when, again, he made when they were revising the budget proposal and revised his weighted student formula. So let me start with the easy part, which was instead of a 37% boost for disadvantaged students, they dropped that weight to 20%. They still had that concentration factor that kicked in after the 50% mark. They also took the big shift was instead of having the same base for all students regardless of their grade level, they actually changed that base, and they said that they sort of took a 4th through 6th grader as the real base. And they said, well, kindergartners get 11% more as their base amount. High schoolers get 20% more. So they were making adjustments based on ideas that high school students are more costly to educate. Whether that's borne out in the research or not is an entirely different question. But it did help the high school districts out. And when you look at winners and little winners and big winners, the next time around, there's not that big discrepancy as much anymore between the high school districts and the other districts.
I don't know if this is the right time, but I'm very curious about where this concentration factor came in, because the striking thing about the first two graphs you put up, I was surprised at how incredibly linear it was as far as the achievement and the. So where do you have a sense of where that?
I feel like I should, because I think we were giving Burst and Kirsten Liu some of the information along the way when they came up with their original one. And I think there's this sense in which, I think sort of in the education literature there are these issues around concentration and how when you have big, huge pockets of poverty, the costs are going to be greater.
Right.
How they actually came up with those specific numbers is a little bit more iffy. I think part of it is this decision-making being driven by where L.A. currently is, because you have to
But
you could estimate a nonlinear function yourself.
Yeah.
Right, and it's not clear from your graphs, because the graphs
and
we're by district, and particularly when you put LA in, that's going to give you a boost at the top end.
We started doing that a little bit with some very simple nonlinear changes, and you don't really get very much. I mean, you don't really get significant results on a squared term, or if you break it up just into different dummy variables for different levels of percent poor. Well, so in the current...
Well, what if you do with 80, which is just to have two lines?
Yeah. And we did that too. We let the slope shift at 50%. So, I mean, we started playing... We haven't done this systematically, but with our quick and dirty attempts, there doesn't seem to be these big nonlinear relationships right now.
So I don't know if this is the right thing to ask us either, but is it fair to say that if this kind of, forget about what the actual parameters are, but if this kind of new weighted student formula is implemented, does that mean that the tie to disadvantage is greater because it's explicit as opposed to all these moving parts? And so therefore, does it create scope for more concerns about our ability to measure that well, or that we're not measuring well? You know what I mean? So there's more opportunity for manipulation.
Yeah. So
if the stakes are more clearly tied to this measure of disadvantage.
So that, I think, is one of the big issues around how they've defined disadvantage. So let me just...
Because in the end, what you were showing in all your beautiful scatter plots is disadvantage is a... There's not many elements of that that are explicitly tied to disadvantage.
Right.
Disadvantage is correlated with housing values, which lead to property tax, you know, down the chain. But it's not like my transfer is an explicit function.
Right.
Much of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so one of the issues with one of the policy discussions that has been going on is how they actually measure disadvantage for this. And it's actually, I should back up here and say, their definition of disadvantage is you are either on the free and reduced price lunch program or you're an English learner. You don't get double counted if you're both of those. You're either one or the other. And they've done some estimates. The Department of Finance has estimated that of all of the English learners out there, about 75% of them are also poor. So you're sort of capturing an additional group of people with this either poor or English learner definition. But some of the pushback on this has come from using English learners in their definition, because a school district is ultimately the one who classifies somebody as being an English learner. So this is kind of one of the issues. And it kind of really got to me at first until I realized that most of the English learners are also poor. So this is a small area that they have discretion over. Certainly isn't ideal, and is definitely one of the areas where they've been getting political pushback on that front.
To the part, everyone in Sacramento is very concerned about the free and reduced price lunch measure. LAO has been trying to push for census, you know, Title I, and you just multiply by three, correlated.
Right.
Yeah.
There are also some states.
You really don't want the principal saying it's 60%.
Sure. But there are some states, I guess there's federal privacy laws and stuff related to this, but some states have gotten around it because you can't separately collect free, like, income stuff. So, but they're very concerned about that.
So these
are some of the issues that they're, I mean, the devil is in the details with something like this, and that's what I think they're trying to work out right now. So since I have 8.5 minutes left according to my watch, and I'll is that right? Do we stop at what time do we stop?
1:30.
Oh, 1:30. Oh. Awesome. This is great. Okay. Then I won't skip too much. So that is one of the, definitely one of the policy discussions here. I was just going to, and I'll let me just come back to a couple others, but let me just kind of go through these couple of little pictures first, which is, it's kind of hard to exactly compare what the old formula would show, which is in orange there, to the new one, because we are changing those grade level weights too. But if you just had changed that 37% poverty weight to a 20% weight, this is what the new formula would give every district. So that's if the base was 7,000. And this just sort of shows you those gains by district type and poverty level with the May version of this. So again, let's just take unified. The higher poverty districts are the big winners with $3,500 extra dollars per kid relative to the lower poverty districts. And again, like I was saying, you don't see that same big gap in gains for any poverty level between unified districts and high school districts like you were seeing before. So we have a couple of reports that go through and do this. And I think I don't know, I think we have finally maybe recovered from the craziness of trying to, I mean, we wanted to be sensitive to the policy time frame and all of this, so we were trying to write this report that sort of showed this at a time when the people in Sacramento were actually needing this information. So, I mean, it's been fun to be part of that policy process in a sense, but then also you kind of have to stick to their deadlines in a way too, which was kind of crazy.
So this is 7 years later. So
this is 7 years later.
Resistance, I guess, would be the first year.
And
the first year.
Thank you. Well, so no, and we don't. And partly that was a really conscious decision because we wanted the focus of the discussion to be on the long run implications here. And the other really key thing that happened, I should have said this, with the May revision was they decided to hold districts. I think they had decided to hold them entirely harmless, if you look at the actual language of the bill, meaning that no district under the new formula would get less than it was getting before. So that this really wouldn't be fully implemented until there was enough money and districts wouldn't be hurt. So it could take some time, but not necessarily. But I mean, I think in a way, I think a lot of people would say it's a good time to be putting something like this on the table when there's not everybody's grabbing at money that's there. So if you could kind of implement it, they might not. Yeah, I don't know. But still, it wasn't really. Did you want to add something?
Well, I think too, the big issue was how you define a loser. So if I get $5 tomorrow and I have $0 today, I consider myself a winner. I have five new dollars, right? But perhaps you told me 5 years ago that you were going to give me 10. And so relative to that, what I think I'm entitled to, 10, I'm only getting 5. Therefore, I'm a loser.
Yeah.
And so that was the main issue. And I think you heard, if you were there yesterday, that's what all about those districts that CSBA and CASBO represent. That was their big
But even with the May revision, though, they were going to hold districts harmless at the undeficited amount, meaning not just the reduced level of income that we currently have, but the one we had promised them before we hit these tough budget times. So it still didn't work. I think they're still sort of hashing out some of these. We don't need to go over that. You can see them all. They're still sort of hashing out some of those details. So on the plus side, this new proposal is, you know, kind of meets some of those principles in that it's directing more money to disadvantaged kids, and we think that they might need more. It's definitely much more simple and transparent. And I didn't really talk too much about this, but it also allowed for the local districts to control where that money was going instead of having all these strings of the current categorical programs. So that's kind of, you know, they get little pluses in those principles columns for these things, but then here are the other considerations. So one of them was, how do you measure student disadvantage? That was sort of a big ticket conversation item. One of the other things that in the budget committee that Maggie and I were at that some of the senators were latching onto was the idea that we should also be making adjustments for the fact that school districts face different costs when it comes to hiring labor, because labor makes up about 85% of a school district budget. And districts in, you know, if you give every district the same amount of revenue per kid and you're in San Francisco, competing with other people who can hire your teachers, compared to Humboldt County, where the competition in terms of wages isn't as steep, your money's not going to go as far in San Francisco. So one of the other, I think, policy discussions has been focused on regional wages, which, I don't know, I've done some work in that area, so it was kind of nice to see them talking about this. Although, actually, now I'm not so sure it's a problem, and I'll show you why in just a second, in a sense. Well, maybe I'll just give you the punchline to that. If you look at these districts with excess taxes, they're the ones that tend to be in these high-wage regions. And if you run those regressions of the revenue limit funds, when you kind of adjust them for these regional wages, so you normalize them by some sort of statewide, I mean, you normalize them by the regional wage in their area, you actually don't get a negative slope between that anymore. So there's some sense in which the excess taxes are this adjustment for regional wages. So I think we're going to sort of probe that idea a little bit more. And I think we've actually talked about some of these other issues. The big issue is like the transition from the old to the new formula. But I think one of the other things that has sort of stayed off the radar screen is that even if we fix these formulas and even if we give schools more money, it's not necessarily going to guarantee better student outcomes. So to sort of expect this to happen just because we've fixed all that, I think, can get us into, you know, dangerous territory down the road where we look and we haven't necessarily bettered ourselves in the way we were hoping for. So I just want to hit sort of really, I'm not going to show you that. Regional wage stuff, we can talk about that at some other time. I'm not even going to talk about that. But I do want to get to this question of are we spending enough now? And again, not if we want this to be a flat line and we think money is going to do something about it. But there are other ways to measure this too. I'm not going to talk about it that way. And that is, well, how many people do we have in our class? You know, what are we doing in California compared to the rest of the U.S.? I mean, part of this at the end of the day is a value judgment. And we want to see, I mean, it is kind of a value judgment. What do we want our schools to look like? If you look at, this sort of compares California to a couple other big states, Florida, New York, Texas, everybody else. And again, this is, I mean, I think this presentation is a combination of Maggie's slides and my slides. I don't know whose is whose anymore, so thanks again. But if you look at funding per pupil, we're a little, and this is the rank. New York's the highest at about 17,000. We're at about 33rd. So this was an 08-09. We're a little below average. We're even a little bit more below average right now. That's, you know, that is what it is. When you look at average teacher salaries in the state, we pay our teachers a lot more because everybody, all employers in California are paying their employees more than the rest of the U.S., so that money doesn't necessarily go as far. So looking at spending per pupil isn't necessarily the right metric, but if you actually translate this into people in the classroom, if you look at students per teacher, we have about 21. Other states, it's more like 15. So we have, and this isn't class size because teachers aren't teaching every minute, but so we have a lot more students per teacher. We have 800 students per counselor. That's about twice the average of the rest of the country. And many more students per administrator too. So we don't have as many big grown-ups in a school relative to, you know, per kid relative to other states. So relatively speaking, we're not necessarily doing so well on that metric.
In fact, it's probably all much worse now.
And it is worse now. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, the recession has hit us harder than other states. You actually,
and the rest of the country is cut 4%. Our class size, average pupil staff ratio increased to 23. The rest of the country is flat.
So, let me. This can kind of show you what's been happening statewide. This is the state's general fund up here, measured on this axis. You know, it was going up until about 07, 08, where it starts to fall down. This is just education spending or revenue divided into those four components I've been talking about. This gray line maps out the part that's state-funded, so the revenue limits and the categoricals. We kind of map what's happening in the state general fund. If anything, we've been a little bit protected. We haven't dropped down quite as far as that has dropped down in percentage terms. But we have obviously been losing money for our schools, which is why we've got these two ballot initiatives for next week. So I wanted just to take the last few minutes and talk a little bit about those. The first one is Proposition 30, which is the governor's tax plan. And the idea here is that there would be an increased sales tax of 0.25% for the next 4 years. There would also be an income tax for high earners that would go on for 7 years, so that if you were making more than $500,000 a year, you would pay 3 percentage points more in tax than you do currently, and that sort of scaled down. So this doesn't really hit you until you're making more than $250,000 a year. If that doesn't pass, I mean, basically the current budget and the current amount that schools have been allocated for the year assumes that this passes. If it doesn't, the state is basically going to cut about $5.3 billion to K-14. Education, K-12 gets most of that cut, and it's actually more than that. It ends up being more like $800 for people. 400 of that is going to cut. They've sort of established that it would come out of the general the those revenue limit pieces. So, but there's this other amount that they haven't really said how it's going to get cut. So that 400 is actually a bit of an under. So you kind of hear that, like last night they were throwing around that $400 number, but there's actually a lot more. If you divide that $5.3 billion up among the 6 million students, it's going to be $800 per kid coming from somewhere.
I'm not sure, because, I mean, the California School Services, which works with all the schools, they're telling them that if it doesn't pass, they got to expect $400, whatever it is, $30 per
kid. Yeah, it's
not $800.
But now you
know, if you read the voter information guide, it explains it all, and it's all about fund shifts and everything else. It's not really worth getting
but
it's a lot of it's a big
it's a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah. And then Proposition 38 is a sort of competing ballot measure that operates basically by adding to the income tax in the state. And so here's a little tax table if you were head of household. So in addition to the taxes that you're already paying, you would now be subject to this. So if I might be wrong about this, but take $50,000 a year, you're going to basically be paying $150 plus 1% of the excess. You're going to basically be paying a couple hundred dollars more in tax per year. If you're up here in this bracket, you're going to be more like an extra couple of $1,000 of tax a year. So this is all operating as add-ons to the current income tax structure. And this is expected to raise an extra $10 billion. 85% would go to K-12. It's about $1,300 per pupil. Some of that is earmarked to sort of pay down debts we've already got right now. So we're looking at somewhere in, I don't know, $1,000-ish per pupil. But both of these, I think it's really important to point out, hinge on these income taxes. And that hinges on how much people are actually earning. So all of these estimates are just estimates, and at the end of the day, I don't know, it's kind of our best guess. I mean, Maggie's been on sort of on a voter information California tour later, so do you want to add anything to these points?
So when I've been doing this with the LAO, they like to focus on kind of the Facebook example. So the state budget assumes we're going to get a lot from the IPO, them all cashing in right about now,
right.
All their money, making like millions for the state. That clearly didn't happen, right? So because we rely so heavily on income tax and on high income earners for capital gains, it's anybody's guess. And no one knows what happens if we actually get less than what they're projecting. Right? Or if 1 year, like in 2006, we over-appropriated $2.4 billion. So what happens if Prop 38 brings in $15 billion?
So anyway, this is what you guys will be faced. If you haven't already sent in your, if you don't vote by mail and you're actually going to the polls soon, these are important to be thinking about for the sake of our school system. So I'm just going to leave it at that with my official stuff. But I don't know if there are any more questions or. We're not.
We'll be done. Heather, and then
okay, good.
I don't know if that much. Back to school.